in every city. We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Where is refuge in the midst of a world that denies your humanity? Where is refuge when you do not seek the spotlight, but the spotlight is thrust upon you? Where is refuge when you are entrusted with the hopes and the dreams of millions who thirst for justice and for peace? Where is refuge when you must constantly turn the other cheek, when your life and the life of your family are violently threatened? Where is refuge when the weight of a country's collective karma rests upon your shoulders? And how ultimately does finding true refuge lead you to provide sanctuary to others?
So we gather to commemorate the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King. In honor of his great compassion, let us consider his journey from finding refuge in his faith to providing sanctuary for others. Now, just as we Buddhists take refuge in the Dharma, in the Sangha, and in the Buddha, Dr. King took refuge in his faith, his community, in his ancestors, and in the profound depth of his humanity. Now, Dr. Martin Luther King's taking refuge is illustrated by what many call his kitchen table conversion, recounted, of course, by the historian Claiborne Carson. But in 1956, King was actually considering quitting the civil rights movement. Around midnight, as he was dozing off, the phone rang. "Listen, Negro, we've taken about all we want from you," the caller hissed. "Before next week, you'll be sorry you ever came to Montgomery."
Dr. King hung up and went to his kitchen to heat a pot of coffee. He had been receiving death threats for weeks since he had accepted a request to lead the bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. He was afraid. Afraid for himself, afraid for his wife, Coretta, and afraid for their infant daughter, Yolanda. How could he wondered. How could he step down without appearing to be a coward? With his head in his hands, Dr. King bowed over his kitchen table and prayed aloud in desperation. He felt weak. He had nothing left in him. And then he listened. Dr. King describes what happened next. "It seems as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, 'Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness, stand up for justice, stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you even until the end of this world.'"
In recounting this experience, Dr. King said, "At that moment, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never experienced him before. Almost at once, my fears began to go. My uncertainty disappeared. I was ready to face anything." At his kitchen table, held within the arms of refuge, Dr. King let go of his fear. He summoned within himself the love, courage, and wisdom necessary to stand up and lead. Empowered, Dr. King came to see the indivisible unity of all beings. Today, we honor his journey from fear to refuge and from refuge to sanctuary for all.
Dr. Martin Luther King challenged this country, and indeed many of his own followers, to embrace the inherent humanity of each and every person, regardless of race, gender, status, ethnicity, nationality, or sexual orientation. One of Dr. King's closest collaborators was Bayard Rustin, a Black man who was openly gay, a Quaker, and a follower of Gandhian philosophy. Dr. King was deeply moved by the horrific murders of civil rights workers James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman. Michael and Andrew were two young Jewish men from New York who traveled to Deepest, Mississippi in 1964 to help register Blacks to vote.
Not content to advocate solely for justice for the Black community, Dr. King began to speak out against the Vietnam War in 1966 at the behest of Thich Nhat Hanh. Fearing for his safety and concerned that his anti-war stance would dilute the momentum of the civil rights movement, Dr. King's closest friends and advisors urged him not to. Yet Dr. King realized that the civil rights movement was, in its essence, a human rights movement, and that moved him to support the peace movement in the U.S. Thich Nhat Hanh went on to tell Dr. King, "Martin, you know something? In Vietnam, they call you a bodhisattva, an enlightened being trying to awaken other beings and help them go in the direction of compassion and understanding."
Martin, the man, exemplified the virtues of a bodhisattva. He understood that true sanctuary leaves no one behind, no one on the outside. And so he declared, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." In her book, Sanctuary, Zen priest Zinju Earthland Manual writes, "Dr. King's dream was as lucid and prophetic as the dreams that Buddha had from which emerged the Four Noble Truths. It was more than a dream about whites and blacks holding hands and singing, eating at the local diner, living in shared neighborhoods, or desegregating schools. The beloved community King spoke of was meant for an entire country, an entire world, not just the Black community. He was encouraging a sanctuary within our country and our world that would be based on peace so that we might live in the magnificent oneness available to all beings."
In his sermon at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, on April 2, 1957, Dr. King said, "The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community." And when I read that, I actually thought about our Sangha and what in the monastery and our further out Sangha geographically. Like, I hope. I do, but I actually feel we are creating the beloved community in all of our missteps. I do feel there's this ongoing commitment in a nonviolent way in our best way possible to build a place of justice and caring.
And so thinking about the prompts, I decided to make an image what this work that we are doing, or the book club and BIPOC groups, and Martin Luther, thinking of MLK. Just wanted to represent a lot of words that was in my mind, how he contributed things like this to come in our conscience so naturally now, and we could discuss openly in a safe space. And each shape is representing a different color, different size, not aligned, but existing as is in space together without judgment. And that's how I appreciate of this affinity group and the Sangha we create.
The way I connect with other marginalized people and with social justice movement is through the whole issue of visibility, of being seen. On one hand, I'm seen because you stand out. You know, you're the only one like yourself in the room. But that type of being seen is being seen through a veil of preconceptions, sometimes biases, through a sense of being an unknown. And so there's the type of being on display that, and self-consciousness that happens. And really what you want to do is find a way to be able to show your true self and for that true self to be seen. And that requires a sangha, that requires other people on the other side of that gaze who are returning your gaze in your full humanity so that the two of you can truly meet, seeing each other, because that work happens on both sides. It's not simply from the outside in, but it's also my ability to trust and to open up. That's the only way we're going to meet in that middle. And so Sangha for me is that practice, is that work, and it's the aspect of that work that I can't do alone.
I've responded to the challenges put forth by Buddha and MLK Jr. by noticing where suffering is happening because of racism, and then taking refuge to ground myself, and then stepping forward into my vows, despite not knowing what the outcome will be, and remembering these words of MLK Jr. There comes a time when silence is betrayal.
I want my life with my family and work with other parents to have a part in realizing Dr. King's vision of the beloved community. The Sangha of family is a site of both great love and great conflict, and so it is a site of practice. As parents, partners, children, and siblings, can we learn together what we need so that we can be skillful and courageous in working for peace and justice in our communities and nation?
You know, through my identity and experiences as a marginalized person, I would say that I've been able to develop so much more compassion than I think I otherwise would have. It was only through my experiences that I really started to see the plight of other marginalized groups. And I began to develop more compassion. And I feel that being trans has made me a better person in that way. And additionally, I would say that taking refuge in the Dharma has given me a greater capacity for doing social justice work. Before, I felt very paralyzed by how insurmountable everything feels. But being part of a group that works at social justice as a community has really been life-changing.
Although we still managed to segregate ourselves in Brooklyn every way possible, it's impossible you know, like we breathe the same air, right? We walk the same streets. We ride the same subways. It's segregation is ridiculous. And so it's just, you know, environmental justice is just a recognition of the need to bring down those barriers, right? Those false barriers that exist, because there is no liberation for myself if everybody else isn't liberated. And same with the environment. You know, there's no protective bubble for me or somebody else, right? We literally are all in this together. And so the work that I feel that needs to be done together with the people I live with in this community. It's very personal.
I came to the Sangha at a time when my entire life was falling apart, and the temple became a refuge for me, a quiet port in the storm, and really became a place that I knew I could trust because of the radical transformation that I encountered there and how my life changed, that I finally had tools that allowed me to really tap into my inner Buddha and to create a new life. And so because I was regularly taking refuge in this new place, then I became very interested in what else was happening. And so the work of the What is Whiteness group, I joined because I knew I could trust what was occurring at the temple. And I'm so grateful I did, because joining What is Whiteness has been a enormous wake-up call for me in facing my whiteness, in facing a lot of actions and unconscious thoughts that I did not have awareness around and I was not shining a light on. And this group has been and continues to be, again, a port in the storm, and more importantly, a place where I feel like I can be a part of the solution as opposed to contributing to more damage. So there is deep refuge in that, because it becomes about refuge where we are creating change together. And I'm so grateful for it.
Taking refuge in the MRO has opened me up to the voices and experiences of Sangha members who have a different identity than me. Relating this to Dr. King, through my work with What is Whiteness, I have felt supported by my white Sangha members to let in the suffering of anti-blackness, to be pierced, and to recognize my privilege.
Yeah, what is very alive in me this year about MLK is recognizing how he grew deeper and wider in his practice, you know, towards the end of his very brief life, becoming more international and also focusing on the, you know, at politics of economics and connecting all the dots. And right now, it feels like to me, our nation has only become even more xenophobic and more nationalistic than during his time. And my wish is that our Sangha continue to deepen and broaden in this awareness about the politics of economics and the getting beyond nationalism and being more global.
My role is to decrease suffering in what ways that I can. And sometimes that's through activism. Sometimes that's through supporting certain candidates. Sometimes that's through donating money, using the privilege that I have in service of others to help them meet their goals. Sometimes it's just being fully present for people and being with them in whatever they're expressing. It doesn't change the sense of bleakness or despair. It doesn't make me feel those things any less, but it does give me a path forward through it and a purpose beyond what I'm personally dealing with. I'm able to have those feelings, but not be controlled by them, and to even realize, to even use them as like a way of connecting with other people who are feeling the same.
There's still a part of me, despite all the practice, that feels very hopeless about this. Like, I kind of know what we're all up against and what it would take to shift such a complex system. And I, you know, at one part you hold where it's not happening, but at the same time, the practice teaches me it doesn't matter. You know, you start and you learn your reach, that your actions matter. It counts. And it's not about fixing the whole thing. It's about doing what you can and just going further. And you can do that. I have done that. And it's been so great to have a group of people to meet with who kind of have this, share this background. And, you know, everyone has a different angle on what they're really passionate about the work, but we all have this practice together. So to come here and to connect has helped.
I think having this engaged activist work in the Sangha has really helped enlarge my view. My best hope of what it is to be a Buddhist is that I am engaged and that I can have an impact. And I may never know what that impact is, but that, you know, the faith in my intention and the shared intention that we have and that we can kind of verify with each other and inspire each other with feeds my faith and also gives me a real sense that this is a refuge worth sharing. This is good, you know, this has the potential to really, you know, keep us alive beyond this generation.
I appreciate the BIPOC book club for the validation I've received. Validation for a very particular kind of pain. The kind of pain that's not well known outside of BIPOC, but often met with disbelief or just simply bypassing it. I thank the existence of the BIPOC book club, a place where I feel safe, learn to express all of me, and most importantly, being heard.
Wait in the water. Wait in the water, children. Wait in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. Who's that girl all dressed in white? Must be one of the Israelites. Wait in the water. Wait in the water, children. Wait in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. God's gonna trouble the water. God's gonna trouble the water.
We're gonna take a very short break and return with a Dharma talk by Shugan Roshi right here.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. After hearing your wise words and seeing your beautiful faces, I really feel like, what more is there to say? But here I am, so I will say a few things. The teachers since the time of the Buddha have made it very clear that karma is an inescapable human truth, a force, that when we don't reckon with it, when we don't understand it, then we are bound by that inattention. We are certain to fall into various mires of confusion and anger and greed and pride and jealousy and fear and all of those factors, those mental factors that arise out of not understanding ourselves, our world, and how we all have one basic nature. And so we are here to both commemorate the life and the work of Dr. King and to acknowledge that this karma is still unfolding. And that when the confusion is great and the anger is severe and the greed is all-encompassing, then the actions that arise out of those, the strength of those poisons will be great and severe. And so we in our country carry this most burdensome karma that didn't actually begin with slavery. It began at the very beginning and maybe before the beginning, but was made articulated or made articulate and what are the words? Unconscionable, unjustifiable as it was justified, irrational as it was rationalized. And all the while, there have always been people, always, who have seen through that, who have worked for all that is good, and they have dreamt of that good. Dreamt that good growing large and broad. And so that iconic speech that we heard a few minutes of this morning, I hope we never tire of that speech, and I hope we do come to the point where it is no longer necessary to hear it because it has been realized. Chike spoke about refuge and sanctuary, and indeed, sanctuary comes from the word holy and divine. And so when we vow to alleviate the suffering of all beings, we are, in that vow, we are requiring of ourselves that we discover our own sanctuary, our Buddha nature. And at the same time that we're recognizing that in those words, when it becomes our vow, that we are binding ourselves to making our lives one of bringing forth that sanctuary in the world. And so for us, that has to be happening here within this Sangha. For it to have any chance of going beyond. And so we raise bodhicitta. Hundreds, thousands, millions of times. We raise bodhicitta, which is a fearless aspiration. It too is a dream. It is a dream of a life that we all sense is possible, based on the lives of those in the past who realized it. A fearless aspiration to free ourselves, which is audacious when we look around and see how few people are free in this world, spiritually, socially, at all levels of society, we see how little freedom there is, and so how audacious it is of us to have that aspiration, but that's the nature of a dream. And we cultivate bodhicitta. We don't just raise it, but we cultivate it, which means to make it strong. We reflect on this precious life. We reflect on impermanence and death. And the more we encounter and embrace and face our suffering, we encounter the impermanence of death that precedes us, of all of those who have come before us, whose lives were precious. How many of them had their lives cut off because of someone else's great anger and delusion? We reflect on the struggle of samsara, this cycle that just repeats itself. Each generation not only repeats itself, but passes itself down through people. And so in Buddhism, when we encounter the truth, the teaching that all samsara arises from deluded thought, we should stop and think about that, reflect on that. All of samsara, all of suffering arises from deluded thinking. That story of Dr. King in his moment of doubt, perhaps hopelessness, despair, and having that increased, it seemed, by that phone call by one who was filled with hatred and ignorance and greed, that led to that, what we might call a raising of bodhicitta, that moment of sanctuary, of encountering the divine in his profound relationship with God. And as he said, almost at once my fears began to go, my uncertainty disappeared, I was ready to face anything. Which that clarity, that kind of clarity and confidence and courage comes often from the darkest nights, from the deepest places, from those moments where going forward is entirely uncertain. Where when looking ahead, there seems to be no open pathway. And in such moment, which is hard won, doesn't mean, I think, that there will be no more struggle, that there will be no more doubt, that there will be no more fear. But then in all of those moments that will continue, there is refuge, there is sanctuary, there is a path, there is, as Dada Roshi used to say, a spiritual imperative. And here, spiritual means, as it is for the Bodhisattva, spiritual explodes to include everything. And so as Dr. King saw that increasingly that economics and militarism, materialism, that all of these forces that were at play were all interwoven and were all creating suffering, were all keeping us apart from that sanctuary, that refuge, which is our birthright. We're born into a time and place that isn't of our choosing. We are born into a collective, a global karma that is not of our choosing. But once we're born and we come into consciousness, I think we have to choose this time and place. We have to decide that we did choose this time and place. Because if not, then it will forever be beyond our reach. It will forever be someone else's world, someone else's possibility. And so to recognize that we are now and have been creating karma, And that karma will either continue to desecrate the sanctuary, will cause harm to sentient beings, which means causing harm to ourselves as well. Or we will diminish and weaken and shift those forces, strengthen all that's good. So we have a choice. That's the characteristic, the sort of defining feature, one of the defining features of the human realm. Not only that we have a choice, but and not only that we must choose, but that we are choosing all the time. Not choosing is not an option. Every time we have a desire and we follow it, we're making a choice. Every time we turn towards what needs to be attended to, we're making a choice. Every time we turn away, we're making a choice. Every time we stand in paralysis or indifference or apathy, we're making a choice. And so to turn towards this sanctuary that is our own body and mind, and we call that the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Buddha is wisdom, the wisdom of all that is real, of all that is true. And that's why working towards justice, which means well-being, which means peace, that's why there is no peace as long as there is no justice. Justice means just. It arises out of our fundamental nature, which is equal, same, unified, one thing. And so when the Dharma teaches that the reality of this moment is just this, is that an accident of language? That just this is the source of justice. It is not an accident. And having faith in Buddha, having faith in this wisdom, which means having faith in Buddha nature, which means having faith in the dignity, the sanctity of every human being. And knowing that, if we are not actively working towards that mutual dignity and sanctity that is the birthright of every person, then in ways, sure, we are working against it. To take refuge in the Dharma is our basic intelligence and our natural ability to be of benefit. And not only our ability, but that's what we're made of. Being a social creature doesn't just mean we live where other people live. Being in a Sangha doesn't just mean that we happen to sit or do liturgy in the same room where other people are sitting or doing liturgy. It doesn't just mean that we share in various responsibilities when we practice together, as we do here. It means the virtue of harmony, the practice of harmony, the perfection of harmony. It's where we show ourselves that we can do this, that it is a dream worth practicing. It is a dream to be realized. Because we all arise from the same basis, the same nature, we call it Buddha nature, we call it emptiness, we call it vast, expansive, limitless space. And that all things are this way. That's our common ancestry. That's our original mother, the mother of all Buddhas, Prajnaparamita. And because it's empty, because it has no fixed form, because it cannot be defined or contained, it can appear as a hell realm, as a realm of hatred and oppression. It can also appear as a realm of loving kindness and compassion. And to take refuge in the Sangha is to take refuge in our mutual dependence. We have to do this together. The very idea that we can alone create suffering or alone bring forth liberation is denying that common ancestry. And so within the Sangha, we learn how to realize, how to practice and realize that sameness and difference, the one in the many. I was listening to a talk just recently that Chike sent me by John Powell, who's a social psychologist who's done a tremendous amount of very beautiful and intelligent work on divisiveness, on othering. And he was speaking about how we live in a time of othering and belonging. Those two essential, ancient, ever-present forces. Those forces that would bring us, pull us apart, and those forces that bind us together. And that when, that in the action, in the activity, in the dream of othering, that all the ways in which we are different, that we appear different, the color of our skin, our gender, our sexual orientation, our faith, our class, our economy, our beliefs, our dress, become the agents, the tools, the weapons of our hatred, of why we are different. And how those differences are pitted against ourselves. And the Buddha Dharma teaches, and we see as on this Bodhisattva path, the profound illusory nature of that. That dream is a lie. It's a fantasy. It's something that is made up in the mind and is given energy. And there is only sadness and sorrow that follows that. For the victor, as well as for those who are the targets. But the suffering is not the same. There have always been people who have changed history, like Dr. King, who had the courage and vision to see through those present deceptions, to see through and not be caught in those forces that would say, no, you can't, you will not. Who have been undaunted by the obstacles, who had the creative power to imagine a world and a people that did not yet exist, that do not yet exist. And not only that, but to gather people together within that dream, so that it becomes a shared vision, a shared aspiration. And then to work together to realize that. And many people, because most people are good, many people do this within their own personal lives, within their own realms, within their own Buddha fields, in small ways that do have impact. We all have this opportunity. And some people do that on a much larger stage. But all of us have a responsibility, an obligation, I would say, to be on this earth is to give. To be receiving requires us to give. To be bound together requires that we give. To see suffering requires that we give. So when Thich Nhat Hanh recognized and told Dr. King that he was seen as a bodhisattva, such a being must have such a strength of conviction to weather the storms that are inevitable. And that's why the bodhisattva is said to be undaunted in the face of certain certain fears. How much suffering, how difficult the obstacles, how long the path, how great the opposition. So when Dr. King taught and spoke about loving your enemies, and we think back to his time, or some of us in this sangha, many in this world, don't have to think back, just think to today. Those people who would have you disappear, who would not see you, not have you belong, who would not have you share the wealth, have access to abundance. So when Dr. King said that we have an obligation to love our enemies, he recognized that that was the most difficult of all requests, the most difficult of all challenges. In a very real sense, the greatest of all spiritual practices. And so he said, many would say that to love one's enemy is just not possible. It's unrealistic. But Dr. King said that, in fact, it is the only practical reality to strive for. Because everything else, anything else, ensures our deprivation, ensures our suffering. And he made a point of saying that when Jesus taught to love one's enemy, he was very serious. As Dr. King said, he wasn't playing. He realized that it was hard to love your enemies. It's difficult to love those people who would defeat you, who would disappear you, who would extinguish you, exclude you. But he went on to say that we, in his words, we have a Christian and a moral responsibility. We have a human responsibility to discover the meaning of those words and to dedicate ourselves to the practice of that teaching. And in the end of that talk that he gave, he said that as he cited a number of reasons why it was an important practice to practice loving one's enemies, he said there's a final reason that he thought Jesus said to love your enemies. And he said it is this, that love has within it a redemptive power. And there's a power there that eventually transforms individuals. Because if you hate your enemies, Dr. King said, you have no way to redeem and to transform them. In a sense, in hating our enemies, we affirm their hatred. We confirm their beliefs that hatred is based on. In a sense, we become that person that we are not, but that they see in us. He said, but if you love your enemies, you will discover that at the very root of love is the power of redemption, transformation, liberation. And so he said, you just keep loving people, and you keep loving them. Which sounds like the renewal of a vow. Which sounds like practice. Waking up today, again and again, coming back to just that. Master Dogen said, know that to give to yourself is a part of giving. And so we have to work with and see clearly and redeem or transform our own hatred, the ways in which we would extinguish ourselves, the ways in which we do not love ourselves, in the purest sense of the word. Dogen said, to give to your family is also giving, and I would say to the Sangha, to your friends, to strangers, and ultimately to our enemies, or those that we would put outside, that we would other. Dogen says, even when you give a particle of dust, rejoice in this. Even when all you can give is the tiniest bit, that seems so insignificant. But Dogen says, from the enlightened view, you should rejoice in that moment of giving. Because in that moment, you authentically transmit the merit of all Buddhas. In other words, we continue this great lineage of bodhisattvas, of great beings, of all traditions, and outside of traditions, who made their lives about that. And in that, we begin to practice the path of a bodhisattva. Dogen went on to say, the mind of a sentient being is most difficult to change. So, oh my goodness. Such simple words. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change, which is might seem ironic given that it is nothing but change. It knows nothing but change. And yet all too often those changes are just to strengthen those patterns of mind and thinking and belief and view that entrench us and separate us. But given that fact that the mind of a sentient being is difficult to change, and then reflect on the mind of a group of sentient beings acting together in confusion, in hatred, in fear, in othering, that mind is going to be very difficult to change. And so, Dogen says, we should keep on changing the minds of sentient beings. So he speaks from that place of fearlessness, which sees clearly what is before us, but is undaunted, is unafraid. Recognizing how difficult it is to change, we should just keep on changing the minds of sentient beings. From the moment that we offer one valuable to the moment that they attain the way, that they shift, that they free themselves. And he says this should and can be initiated by giving. And this is why it's the first of the paramitas, the great practices of the bodhisattva. And when we reflect on it, we realize that there's no limit to our capacity to give. This morning was a morning of giving. And so all of you who are involved in this morning and making this possible gave to all of us this inestimable gift of compassion and loving kindness and the dream. And so when Shanti Deva says, with joy I celebrate the virtue that relieves all beings from the sorrows of the states of loss, and I rejoice in the virtue that places those who languish in the realms of bliss, who liberates them, who brings them to begin to see that no matter how convincing a life of hatred may be, no matter how just the reasons, there's no real human life there. There's no real human life there. There is a kind of a life, but not a human life. Not in the sense that we are born to be, fulfilling our potential. And that given over to a life of hatred, that we could somehow compartmentalize, contain that hatred, and only channel it towards those that we hate, but not towards everyone. It doesn't work that way. And so one's whole life becomes infused with that non-virtue, as Buddhism would call it. But in the very same way, when we bring forth that joy of virtue, of loving kindness, of compassion, of generosity, of giving, not only can we not contain the direction of that, but we don't want to. There's no need to. The very purpose of it is for it to be uncontained. And so we can begin to see how much easier life is. There's no longer the need to build walls, to separate out, to try and compartmentalize. Those days of folly, of foolishness, of delusion, simply don't make sense anymore. At the deepest level and at the most surface level, that intention, that great intention, that ocean of great good that seeks to place every being in a state of bliss, and every action that we take is for the benefit of all. Let this be our delight and our joy. When we think about how, what will make me happy, possessing what, achieving what, being in what situation, what Shantideva here is saying, that when every action, every thought, every desire, every intention, every word, every action is based in, arises out of wanting to be a benefit in this world, that that brings delight and joy. That is our happiness. And even in those moments of struggle, when we falter, when we waver, when we're based in that great intention, that ocean of good, I think there are not so many regrets. There's not actually so much confusion. We may be unclear about our next step, but we're not unclear about the ground of that step, about the direction that step needs to be moving in, about what our lives are about. And so, just as all the Buddhas of the past embrace the awakened attitude of mind, that great intention, and in the precepts of compassion and non-harming and loving kindness and generosity and patience and ferocious determination, all of those virtues in which they step by step abode and trained, are just so. And for the benefit of all beings, I will also adopt this attitude of mine. I will make this my life's work. And in those precepts, in that aspiration, cultivating those qualities, I will abide and train myself. Can you imagine a better life? I can't. And in imagining that life, success or failure, moving fast or slow, somehow are not so important. And so may we immerse ourselves in that great ocean of good, and work together, because there really is no other way, is there?
Dr. King's legacy teaches us that justice and freedom are our shared birthright. Can we hold that in our heart, mind, with love, with ferocious determination? Sanctuary is the home we can return to when our lives are under threat, where we can face what's difficult to love and have a place where we can truly say, I am home. Spiritual teachers often emphasize sanctuary's inner dimensions, that our true home is within. Homelessness, on the other hand, can be viewed as a forced experience or one in which there is a spiritual void in being or feeling at home. Fighting for civil rights like the right to vote, is promotion of the magnificent oneness available to all beings. Dr. Cornel West says, justice is the public face of love. And bell hooks said, we yearn to end the lovelessness that is so pervasive in our society. I think that's still true. She says, love is as love does. And it is from bell hooks that I learned that love is a verb. We need to expand the circle of human concern, embrace the beautiful mosaic that is Sangha, well beyond the MRO, the Sangha of this world. This morning, the people of African descent group hope to open the window just a little bit to our history, to our inheritance in this country, to try and show a little how difficult it was for Dr. King, the man, to act in the face of fear, not just fear, but the fear of death for himself and his family. Action in the face of fear. He took refuge in his faith, and in that showed us what was possible. He showed us what he was willing to do to promote harmony and justice among all sentient beings, because he found the courage of his convictions. This is the strength of truth. This is the strength of love backed by courage. Thank you all for joining us. Special thank you to my Dharma brothers and sisters in the PAD group and to all the labors of USEN and HOKU and SHOAN and the MRO affinity groups for MR affinity group beings for reflecting and sharing of themselves in this commemoration. On behalf of us all, in the name of life and the works of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., onward, Sangha, onward, in the name of our interconnected humanity and in honor of our vows. Please stay safe and well, and love to you all.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.